Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With the possible exception of North Korea, America is the world leader in incarceration. With one in 108 people in jail, it is the country with the largest percentage of its population behind bars. It also has several of the world's most notoriously violent prison gangs, membership in which is a means of survival, as California inmate Brian Curlis tells a documentary film crew.
My idea was that we couldn't organize the Mexicans, we can't organize the blacks, but we could organize the whites.
Pelican Bay State Prison is a supermax penitentiary in Crescent City, California, where those high up in the gang hierarchy are held in the tightest lockdown in the state. Graham Wood, contributing writer for The Atlantic, visited the prison to explore an academic theory that, in their own brutal and effective way, prison gangs have become the unlikely custodians of governance and order behind bars. In an article called How Prison Gangs Took Over, Wood dispels some myths about prison gangs and explores their influence over life on the outside. Graham Wood, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Graham, you visited Pelican Bay State Prison. This is in Crescent City, California, where a number of high-level gang members have been incarcerated. Now, you were there when corrections officers were watching inmates file out into the yard. What did you see?
Well, I should first say what I expected to see. Now, you think of these prisoners who are there because they've broken the law. And according to the California prison authorities, they're also there because they're gang members. That's where they try to concentrate gang members in the California system. So you expect to see some kind of disorder, a lot of people who don't like following the rules. And instead, what you see is an immensely rule-bound atmosphere. People walk out in a particular order. They sit in a particular place. And even once the groups start forming in these clusters in the places where they've staked out and kind of planted the flag of the particular race or gang, then they send out scouts in a particular way, and they walk in very carefully chosen patterns. So what I expected to see was disorder, and what I saw, in fact, was one of the more orderly environments you could find.
Mm. You wrote in the article about sort of color-coding inmates so that they were in safe numbers within their own gangs. Are they acknowledging that these gangs exist, so we just want to work with it, or what are they doing to prevent?
If you ask the California authorities, they'll say that they've produced a very carefully orchestrated systems so that gangs can be mitigated in their effects. In practice, what that means is that they look at the gang structures and in some ways they replicate it in their own system. Every inmate gets a color-coded identification card, and that card really corresponds to the presumptive gang that he's a member of. And in many ways, you see that the California system really works with the gangs in a way that it probably wouldn't appreciate my characterizing it that way, but there's no doubt that the institution and the informal institutions that are incarcerated there are in some ways in cahoots just to keep order in California prisons.
Hmm. Well, tell us more about that. Some of the research on prison gangs' origins and behavior that you quote in the article comes from David Scarbeck. He's an economist, I believe. When did prison gangs first appear in American penal systems and why?
In California in particular, prison gangs first appeared in the 1950s, which is an interesting thing because California has had prisons for at least 100 years before that. So the question that David Scarbeck, who, as you say, is a political economist in London, was trying to figure out was why did California prison gangs only arise after the prison system had been around for so long? And the answer that he came away with was that California prisons had particular demographic shocks and shifts that took place around that period and in the decade or so that followed. And before then, you would have prisoners coming in, doing their time, and really just telling each other as they came in how to act when you're in prison. Do this, don't do that, don't rat on people, don't take other people's stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the incoming prisoners would learn how to behave that way.
So there was the sort of a convict code of sorts.
Precisely. Yeah. And it was possible in a very informal way to indoctrinate new arrivals. What Skarbek found was that around that period, you started to see lots of people showing up, and a lot of people who were coming to prison for the first time and who were from demographic groups that might not play well with others, really young men, for example. And so when they came in, they could no longer be assimilated with the convict code, and instead you had a prison system that really cried out for some kind of order that was no longer being provided by the previous means. And that's where prison gangs stepped in.
And this was flourishing when?
This was from 1956 for the couple decades that followed that were really the genesis moments for what we now think of as the California prison gangs.
Let's look at some of the misconceptions about how prison gangs operate. One, that there is unresolvable hatred between them, and that they are simply street gangs locked up. What are we not understanding in that statement?
Well, you know, some of the gangs seem to exist only for the purposes of racial hatred. The Black Guerrilla Family would be one group that whose name really describes it as much as you need to know, but also the Aryan Brotherhood. And there are two Hispanic gangs, which you really can't be a member of unless you're Hispanic. So it looks on the surface like these gangs exist because they want to promote the supremacy of a race. In fact, you see that the gangs get along in some ways quite well in a transactional way with each other. And a lot of people who you would think have ideological commitments to race hatred, those really vanish when it comes to living cheek by jowl with other gangs and getting along with them.
One of the things I found really fascinating is that the threat of prison is nothing compared to the threat of the prison gang. It actually ripples out onto the street. Tell us about what's going on there.
Well, if you're on the street and you rob a drug dealer who's affiliated with a prison gang, then you might be able to get away for a while. You could just move to another city, for example. But the prison gangs know that if you're the type of person who's out there robbing drug dealers, there's a really good chance you're going to end up on the inside too. And that means that prison gangs, according to Skarbek's thesis, perform a function for criminal enterprises on the outside, which just allows them to know that someday they'll be able to find you. When you appear in prison, you'll get back on that gang's radar, and they keep meticulous records, so they know if you've ripped off someone on the outside, and they'll come get you and exact revenge when eventually, as you surely will, you end up in prison too.
Graham Wood is with us. He wrote an article for The Atlantic called How Gangs Took Over Prisons. Skarbek also considers prison interaction and behavior from a market-based model. So talk to us about some of the skills developed for communication, for initiation, for leadership inside of the prison gangs.
Well, one skill is human resources. When you arrive, there is something called a new arrivals questionnaire, an NAQ, which will be passed to you in your cell, and you'll be expected to answer a lot of questions. Things like what bars you drank at on the outside, what your offenses were, who your associates were, who else you know in prison. So the gangs, to be effective, really need to know what their resources are. And so they will take very careful records of what you say, and they'll even verify it.
Fact check them.
Yes, they have accounts on news services and social media, so they can go to see if you really are friends with so-and-so and whether you're going to be useful for the gang in the ways that you say. I should say that California prisons prohibit possession of cell phones at all. So when inmates have them and are able to fact-check people this way, it's because they have a pretty sophisticated way of getting contraband, keeping it, and using it for the gang's ends.
In fact, you quote that in 2013, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation confiscated 12,151 phones. A reasonable guess, about a tenth of all cell phones in the system. So how many have them?
Well, the total number of inmates in the California system is about 10 times 12,000. So statistically, that means that about one cell phone might have been confiscated per inmate in the entire system. There are some prisons where there are no cell phones confiscated at all. But the size of this number really demonstrates the degree to which inmates have free reign of the place.
Hmm. So what is being done? What are some of the strategies for breaking down the considerable power inside of prisons?
The reason the gangs arose in the first place was because the prison system in California was deeply disordered, and it remains so. And they have really tried all manner of things that many people would call unconstitutional to try to break up prison gangs. One effort that I saw, which really goes beyond what you find in any prison system elsewhere in the United States, is what they call the SHU at Pelican Bay, and that's the Secure Housing Unit. And what this is essentially is a large part of the prison where every inmate is held in solitary confinement, in some cases for many years at a time. And really, this is at the farthest edge of the envelope of what we think of as permissible for American human rights and civil liberties. It does do one thing, though, which is keep people from talking to each other, and it severely disrupts what gang members and anyone else who happens to be in that facility can do to organize themselves and run a big organization from the inside.
Now, solitary confinement is being used increasingly in American penitentiaries as a threat, as a deterrent. But you mentioned, you know, furthest edge of what is permissible, in fact, something that human rights organizations are advocating against. Is it truly effective?
It's effective in that individuals who are kept there are prevented from talking to other people and from organizing in any easy way anyway. Whether it's effective is not, of course, the only question that we have to ask about it. Is the price that we pay for the dehumanizing and true psychological pain that we cause to these people worth paying in order to disrupt an individual's ability to run a gang? After all, the gangs do perfectly well even without their heads being completely in the loop.
Mm. Well, I'm going to stay on that for just a second because this is something that you've been criticized for, or your article has been criticized for. I'm speaking of Shane Bauer. He was held captive in Iran for 2 years, reported on prisons. Writing in Mother June's magazine, he took great exception to your article, especially what he called, quote-unquote, justifying the use of long-term solitary confinement. What do you say to that?
I think you should read the article a little more carefully. My job was to go there to describe what I saw, and what I saw looked pretty torturous to me. The description that I gave of the Pelican Bay SHU was of a place that had really the air of dystopian science fiction to it. I described it as the kind of place where humans were placed in suspended animation against their will. That sounds pretty horrifying, and I wouldn't hesitate to call it torture. He found that description not so bad, which is funny because he has written well about Pelican Bay from the perspective not of a journalist but of an advocate of the human rights of prisoners. And I quite agree with him that the Pelican Bay SHU is an affront to certainly what I would like in a society that I'm part of. But my job was to describe what I saw there, and I saw something horrifying, and I placed it in the context of this view of prisons as a place that is broken down enough that we have to rely on prison gangs for maintenance of order. Mm. The SHU is something that I described as another way we can do that, and I hope it's not an option that recommends itself very much based on what I've described.
Well, Graham Wood, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Graham Wood, a contributing writer for The Atlantic. A link to read his article, How Prison Gangs Took Over, is on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Now, while we may think that gangs are a problem specific to prisons or big cities, rural areas are also grappling with the issue. Next up, how one fish and wildlife cop in Northwest Washington is dealing with gangs that have established turf on public lands. That story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, there are an estimated 750,000 gang members in the U.S. And while we may think that gang violence is relegated to big cities, rural communities are increasingly grappling with their rivalries, turf wars, and even drive-by shootings. Our next story comes to us from Northwest Washington, where gang members are frequenting public recreation lands, including boat launches, fishing holes, and hunting areas. Austin Jenkins brings us the story.
Officer Chad McGarry pulls his state-issue pickup into a public boat ramp. We're near Potholes Reservoir in Grant County in central Washington.
I have three kids myself, and I don't come down here unless I'm armed, and I know where I'm going to be going fishing.
That's because this fishing spot is gang turf. Just check out the graffiti.
Every single sign that we have here is tagged up.
So are the public bathrooms, even the large rocks and boulders. Everywhere you look, there's gang graffiti on top of gang graffiti. Giant spray-painted letters in blue.
And then crossed out in red saying, blue came in and tagged it up, and red says, no, this is our area, not your area.
Red for Norteño, blue for Sereno. These are the main rival gangs around here. According to the sheriff's office, there are more than 400 known gang members in this sprawling rural county of just 85,000 people. Last year, there were 3 gang-related homicides, 66 times when someone brandished or fired a gun, and 337 reports of gang tagging. Grant County Deputy Joe Harris is the one who compiles these stats. He can also tell you the stories behind the numbers, like the time he responded to a call of a 10-year-old boy wounded in a drive-by shooting.
And he's just laying there in his bed, and he gets woken up by a gunshot, a bullet that went through his head.
He survived. Police believe the boy's older brother was the intended target. Gangs in rural America are not new. The National Youth Gang Survey showed a dramatic increase in rural gangs between 2002 and 2008. The last year, those numbers are available. In the Northwest, that can mean a collision of outdoor recreation and gang culture. As we drive, Officer McGarry spots 3 boys fishing in a small creek. It looks like a Mayberry moment, but when he stops to check their fishing licenses, he finds some marijuana. Soon, the youngest of the boys is in handcuffs.
Where do you guys live at?
As McGarry writes him a ticket for the marijuana, he notices gang writing on the kid's shoe.
Norteño killer?
Yeah.
We'll call this kid Eduardo to protect his identity as a minor. He claims membership in a local Sereno gang, the Southside Locos. Eduardo tells Officer McGarry he's been expelled from school, he can't read, he's on juvenile probation, and he's just 13. After Eduardo's uncuffed and with his mother present, I ask him if he's a gang member or just an associate.
Gang member.
A gang member, and you're proud of it.
Yeah.
Why don't you just want to be a nice kid and go fishing and get a job, go to college?
Because our life's boring.
Boring?
Yeah.
It's hard to believe I'm having this conversation in such an idyllic setting, a fishing hole surrounded by pasture land, a big eastern Washington sky overhead. I ask Eduardo if I should believe what the cops are telling me about gangs in this pocket of rural Washington.
They say that you guys burglarize, you tag, you run some marijuana, and you shoot at each other. Does that pretty much sum it up?
Yeah.
So they're telling me the truth?
Pretty much.
By now, the other 2 boys have come up from the fishing hole. The oldest is 17. I'll call him Jose. He, too, says he's a Southside Loco and has an arrest record. I'm still trying to understand.
You're out here near Royal City, Washington. Why do you have to be a member of a gang?
That's how it is, man. It's just how it is.
It's just what everybody's doing?
No, I'm just saying that's how I grew up and stuff. That's how it is, man.
Were your parents gang members?
No, but just like, it's what you see, man. You know, that's how you grow up. It's a place where you grow up like that.
Back in his truck, Officer McGarry says he ran Jose's name on the computer. An officer safety alert popped up. He's known to carry a gun. It's a warning McGarry takes seriously. He says police out here in Sagebrush Country have had some pretty violent run-ins with gang members in recent years. Even off-duty officers have been targeted, including McGarry. It happened 2 years ago.
That's when I got burglarized.
McGarry and his wife came home to find their house ransacked. But the real shock came when they ventured downstairs. Spray painted on the wall was a Sereno gang tag.
They put a big SSL on there, Southside Crazy Boys, saying, "This is the gang that took your stuff."
It happened just as Officer McGarry was leaving the Royal City Police Department to join Fish and Wildlife. He thought he was signing on to chase poachers, and he does. But he can't escape the gangs. His new assignment? He's been named to the Columbia Basin Anti-Gang Task Force, a first for a Washington Fish and Wildlife officer. I'm Austin Jenkins reporting.
Several African-American athletes defended Adrian Peterson's right to beat his child. When word of mouth continues, a black woman says it's time to stop thinking that violence is the way to teach kids a lesson. That story after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A few public figures have bucked the tide and defended Adrian Peterson, the Minnesota Vikings running back facing felony child abuse charges in Texas. Among them, NFL players Roddy White and Mark Ingram. One of the most repeated sound bites came from former NBA star Charles Barkley on NFL Today, who was asked if it is ever permissible to hit a child.
Listen, we spank kids in the South. I think the question about did Adrian Peterson go overboard? But listen, Jim, we all grew up in different environments. Listen, every black parent in my neighborhood in the South would be in trouble or in jail under those circumstances.
Barkley, White, and Ingram are all African-American, something Khadijah Costley White, assistant professor at Rutgers University, noted in an article for Quartz, with a title that pretty much makes her position clear. It's time we reject the idea that beating our kids is part of black culture. Khadijah Costley White, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So Barkley's saying this happens in the South, and you point to the case that some scholars have made about the connection between black parenting traditions and slavery. Expand upon that for us, if you would.
So the idea is that the brutality and the violence of slavery actually kind of repeats itself and is reenacted in the relationship between parents and children as manifested in corporal punishment.
Hmm.
So that's the theory. I mean, but, you know, one has to also remember that it's only a slight increase in the African-American community, corporal punishment. The rate is only slightly higher in the African-American community.
Could you break that down for us? Because we should note, African-Americans do not have a monopoly on corporal punishment of their children. Do we have any kind of demographic breakdown of whether people or not spank or whoop, in this case, their kids?
Yeah, I've seen basically stats that say anywhere between 80 to 90% of African Americans say that they spank their children, and anywhere between 70 to 80% of white and Hispanic adults and Asian adults in America admit to spanking their children. So at best, we have a 10% difference, and, you know, with all sorts of other methods in place, it could be even much smaller than that.
Well, then why then is Peterson's arrest and defense being cast as an African American issue? Is he being demonized?
Yeah, I mean, I'm often confused by this because I think, I'm hoping at least, that people are kind of rushing to defend him as an African-American. They're concerned that he's being singled out for a behavior that's very American because he's African-American. I think what people like Charles Barkley, who is wrong in every possible way, but what he's trying to point out is that actually violence against children is quite common. I think, though, you know, to move on beyond that and say, well, this is just an African-American cultural phenomenon, it is not quite right. I think there is a way in which black people might hold more closely to spanking because of the belief that, you know, there's this national mass media produced, created, and constructed narrative around black children as wild, black children as, you know, not being controlled, not being disciplined. And so I think there's something to the idea that African-Americans might cling more to spanking as kind of proof that they discipline their children, that they are strict. And so there might be a cultural element there in a kind of a concern that that black parents too want to be more strict with their children because they believe that, you know, black kids have a lot less room for error, a lot less room for mistakes in our society. They get punished at higher rates for the same kinds of infractions. They get suspended at higher rates. They get sent to prison and jail and juvenile detention centers at higher rates. And so there's kind of a pervasive concern that African-American kids don't have as much leeway for mistakes as the parents might be harsher in order to kind of protect them. But that all aside, what we really know is this is an American phenomenon. And it's actually hopefully kind of a moment to really say, why do we support violence against children? You know, how do we say that we're against bullying, but we also say that parents, because they're bigger and stronger, should be able to inflict pain?
Well, in a report on the Peterson case, at law enforcement interviews obtained by CBS's Houston affiliate, and, you know, there's a text there from Peterson to the child's mother that he had swatted his son 10 to 15 times, not sure because he, quote, doesn't ever count how many pops I give my kids. Now, the question here is, is there a clear line between discipline and abuse? You know, it's very difficult for anyone to judge how a parent disciplines a child. Do you think there is a standard there?
I don't, and I'm really glad that you brought up that point. No one ever gets trained on where that line is. I think people kind of wing it, right? I mean, there's so much about parenting that people think is natural, and you just have kids, and a lot of times people just end up reproducing the same things that their parents did to them. A lawyer would tell you there are ways that courts would determine whether something was abuse or not. I think even around the Adrian Peterson case, though, we can see that there was legal ambiguity because the first time a grand jury was convened, from what I understand, they did not put out a charge for Adrian Peterson, but the second time they did. But the truth is, this kid was beaten so hard that his scrotum was bruised. His father's a professional athlete. And so we should be able to kind of easily point to something like this and say, no, this is abuse.
I want to pick up on that point because since you are addressing the African-American community, you know, it's time we reject the idea that beating our kids is part of black culture. Would this have played out differently if Peterson were white?
Look, the reason I wrote that piece specifically targeting the black community is because when you look at Adrian Peterson and you look at Ray Rice and you look at the ways in which some people have just had a knee-jerk reaction to defending people who are abusing vulnerable and weaker people, I couldn't stand to listen to this be used as an excuse of black culture. I couldn't stand for people to pretend as if this was something that people couldn't touch. Because it was distinctively black, because it's not. It's not distinctively black. It's not even that unique to us, right, to African-Americans, the process of spanking or even domestic violence. These things are not just kind of located in these small silos. They're part of our culture. They're reflective of our larger culture, and we actually have to talk about that. But I would hope that if somebody who was a white professional baseball player or basketball player or football player beat their child this severely, I would hope that we would have the same kind of outrage about it. These types of spankings, this type of abuse has long-term effects on children. They've showed that spanking has all sorts of negative outcomes from anxiety, depression, destroying and deteriorating the connection between parents and children. And so, you know, it's really easy to make someone a symbol, which is part of the question I kind of tackle in Adrian Peterson, is saying, you know, we want to try to uphold them. People are trying to uphold them as a racial symbol, but really we have to think about what this means for this child.
Khadija Cosley-White, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Khadija Cosley-White, assistant professor at Rutgers University. Her article, It's Time We Reject the Idea That Beating Our Kids is Part of Black Culture, originated on Quartz, but it's been picked up by several online magazines and news aggregators. There's a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Has the Adrian Peterson story made you think differently about the definition of domestic violence? What's the line between discipline and abuse? Were you ever spanked as a child? And do you think it did you some good? Would you ever do the same to your own kids? What are the alternatives? Let us know on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. You can join the conversation on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Legislating what constitutes discipline and what counts as abuse is one of those thorny questions of human behavior that many people have clear opinions on. When Word of Mouth returns, we're going to hear about a proposal for how to relegate machines. Who should govern robots? We'll explore that question when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1927, President Calvin Coolidge signed a bill into law creating the Federal Radio Commission. Before that time, anyone who applied for a broadcasting license could get one. So as the number of stations grew, so did competition and crowding on the airwaves. 7 short years later, the 5-person FRC was abolished, and broadcasting authority was handed over to the Federal Communications Commission we know today. Almost 90 years later, one man is arguing to revive the FRC, not for regulating radio, but robotics. Ryan Kahlo is assistant professor at the University of Washington School of Law and former research director at Stanford Center for Internet and Society. He recently authored a paper called The Case for a Federal Robotics Commission, and it was published by the Brookings Institution. Ryan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ryan, this sort of idea, on the face of it, sounds a little silly. Do people take it seriously?
Yeah, I mean, I think people have been taking it quite seriously, serious enough, in fact, to criticize it extensively. And I think that it's interesting. When I first started doing robotics law a few years ago, I would go to give a talk or I'd talk about my work, and people would sort of react and be like, "You're working on robotics law. You must be thinking about Isaac Asimov or the three laws of robotics," and maybe with a little chuckle. But today we recognize that robotics is increasingly a part of our lives, and we've seen the law already begin to react to it. And so a proposal like this is taken, I think, as it should on its merits.
So why an agency? Why not have existing agencies pick up some of the jurisdiction? Healthcare robots could be dealt with by the FDA or HHS, or the Highway Traffic Safety Administration might deal with self-driving cars, for example.
Well, that's exactly how it's being done today. So, of course, the Federal Aviation Administration deals with drones and et cetera. The Securities and Exchange Commission deals with high-speed trading algorithms. I'm not saying that these particular agencies should not be handling the robotics and artificial applications that they already do. Rather, I'm proposing that in order for the agencies to accrue expertise faster, that they'd have a body that was a central repository for expertise. So the idea would be that the FAA would continue to regulate drones, but when it had an issue that came up, for instance, certifying whether the sense and avoid technology in the drone were safe enough, it would have a trusted, impartial repository of expertise that it could go to for help.
What sort of hypothetical issues can you imagine now that would be difficult to address without a robotics commission?
Well, I mentioned in the paper a few years ago the notion of sudden acceleration and the question of whether or not that was a software glitch that caused Toyotas to suddenly accelerate. And Congress asked the Department of Transportation to figure it out, and it couldn't. And it had to recruit NASA. It had to literally, went to NASA and say, hey, would you mind taking a break from putting, robots on Mars or repairing a space station to look at this Toyota for us? And that's fine to do every once in a while. But as more and more activities become a function of software and hardware, you're not going to be able to turn to something like NASA each time. And so in the paper, I go through a bunch of, not hypothetical, but actual problems we're experiencing today, where the relevant agencies are not making much traction. One of them involves, from your wonderful intro, the Federal Communications Commission. It's trying to figure out how to get smarter radios that can hop between frequencies and change their power. It's been trying to do that for 10 years. Everybody agrees it's a good idea. It's more efficient to have smarter radios, but no one can figure out how to do it in a way that's safe and palatable. And that's partly because they just don't have the expertise to assess it. Another example I mentioned was, one of the really important things with drones is going to be if they're going to fly autonomously, like for instance to do delivery of goods at your house as Google and Amazon plan to do. If you're going to have autonomous drones, they're going to need to be able to sense and avoid one another, and someone's going to have to certify whether that technology is working. Right now, the FAA, in my view, just doesn't seem to have the understanding of the technology to let it proceed easily. And so as a consequence, they're saying no autonomy at all. And so these are the sorts of puzzles that I think that a Federal Robotics Commission could help with.
And tying both of those together, the idea of self-guided drones and cars that accelerate by themselves, the idea of driverless cars, how will those be regulated? Or what sort of questions might come up that the FRC might address?
Well, right. So when Nevada was a real pioneer here, and in fact, the states have been taking the lead on driverless cars, and I think that's very appropriate. You know, historically, licensing cars and so forth has been a state-by-state power. And so they wrote the first driverless car legislation. But when they did so, they really didn't have anybody to ask about it. I mean, they had Google telling them what they thought was the right approach, and that's one company with a particular implementation. But they didn't really have anybody to turn to. That would have been a great instance for them to be able to turn to the Federal Robotics Commission. One of the things they might have avoided, for instance, is a definition of artificial intelligence that just didn't work. And if you look at the state of Nevada, they passed a law defining artificial intelligence, and because it didn't work, they ended up having to repeal that law soon thereafter and then pass a new definition. And those sorts of things, I think, would be avoided if you had non-industry, trusted government expert body in order to weigh in on these issues.
We're speaking with Ryan Kalo. He's a law professor who argues that America needs a new federal agency for coping with questions related to robotics and their increasing role in our everyday lives. His paper, The Case for a Federal Robotics Commission, was published by the Brookings Institution. Okay, so imagine what this would look like. How big would it be? Who might it employ?
Well, I think it would be small at first. I think it would employ a group of PhDs trained in the relevant areas. And when I say the relevant areas, I mean we would have to isolate the specific kinds of interesting issues, difficult issues that robotics raises. So that would be people who are electrical engineers, computer scientists, people working on human-robot interaction. And they would be available, much in the same way as the Congressional Research Service is available to answer Congress's questions, they would be available to work on these issues. When they weren't being asked directly by, say, an agency, they didn't have a particular problem that they were parachuting in to help with, they would generate knowledge. They would do research. They would talk to stakeholders. They would have a role, I think, in channeling funding to the appropriate places and so forth. You know, there would be a low, hopefully very low-level amount of bureaucracy. But you're talking about not a lot of people. You're talking about fewer than 100 people, most of whom were trained experts in areas of relevance to robotics.
You've mentioned that your paper has been taken seriously enough to be criticized. What are some of the criticisms of your proposal?
So far, some of the most sort of, I think, interesting and fair criticisms of the proposal have been, number one, is it really just going to be an advisory capacity? Doesn't the history of government show that something like this is going to morph into a more regulatory body and it would be inappropriate to have top-down regulation of this technology? That's one, I think, very fair concern that people have voiced. Another has to do with Is robotics really distinct enough from its previous and constituent technologies, like computers and the Internet, that it deserves separate treatment? I mean, these points are well taken. I try to address them in the paper. But, I feel like I've already succeeded at one level because the whole point of this thought experiment is to get people thinking about the right legal and policy infrastructure of robotics. And I've offered the idea of a Federal Robotics Commission, but other people have offered the idea of principles or the idea of specific laws or other, a global think tank was an interesting idea I've heard, or, the Robo-Law project in Europe is coming out with a comprehensive set of principles based on case studies that they did. So there's all kinds of different options. I think the only really poor option here, Virginia, is not to do anything. I think not doing anything, especially in the United States, will lead to poor policy outcomes, and maybe we won't realize the benefit of this technology.
So you're talking about need for a federal robotics agency, but, we don't have a federal Internet Commission. I think all of that, or most of it, is handled by the FCC. Isn't there a stronger case to be made that there should be a way to advocate for, to initiate policy, and to interface with states on Internet law?
Well, I mean, you hear the claim from time to time that that there should be heavier regulation of the Internet. I don't agree with that. I think that what happened with the Internet was a pretty interesting and unique thing. It wasn't that it was not governed. There are things like ICANN and the technical bodies that govern the internet that actually do get together and set the protocols that determine the internet. They do so at a global level. That's because the internet is, of course, intrinsically global in a way that robotics is not, in a sense. But I will point out that the health of the internet has been a product of laws. And there are people who say, oh, we should have been, you know, we should be hands off of the internet. Well, Congress passed a very important law around the internet in the mid-90s called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which immunized platforms like Facebook for what users do on those platforms. We also passed rules for what to do about copyright on the internet. And these two kinds of regulations, along with these governance bodies that I mentioned, and also until recently, some at least understandings or norms around net neutrality, not allowing ISPs and networks to control what happens on those networks overly, have been crucial to the internet becoming the commercial and political and cultural force that it is today. So the idea that, you know, we didn't do anything with the internet, we shouldn't do anything with robotics, that's historically obviously false. And I'm hoping that the Federal Communications Commission will listen to the overwhelming will of the people and give us some solid net neutrality rules going forward. But other than that, I think that we're in a pretty good place when it comes to the internet. And I think that we had the technical and legal expertise in place because of some early interventions and because these governance bodies occurred.
Ryan Kalo, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Washington, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ryan's also a former research director at Stanford Center for Internet and Society and authored the paper, The Case for a Federal Robotics Commission. It was published by the Brookings Institution, and you'll find a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. While lawyers and academics work out the regulatory demands of robots, there's one android in development that New Englanders would welcome, a robot that can rid your yard of ticks. Scientists at the Virginia Military Institute are working on such a robot that could help reduce the risk of tick-borne illnesses. Kelly Libby has the story.
Meet the Tick Rover. It's a robot that looks like a toy remote-controlled truck. David Livingston is on the team that invented this mini exterminator. He's a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Virginia Military Institute.
We designed it to be robust in the areas with logs and sticks and pine cones and that type of thing so that it won't be stopped by minor obstacles. It'll just, you know, roll over them.
If you hate ticks, you might appreciate what this little four-wheeled machine can do. It's capable of killing most, if not all, of the ticks in a whole backyard. And how do you do that? By giving ticks what they love, our breath. Sullivan and his colleagues have figured out a way to lure the ticks using a tube with holes punched in it that releases carbon dioxide. To the ticks, that CO2 release is essentially a big, glorious, intoxicating human exhalation. The rover then rolls along the tube, picking up the lovesick ticks using something else ticks love, your jeans. The machine is outfitted with what's essentially a denim skirt. The rover drags a piece of fabric behind it, and the ticks crawl on. The fabric is laced with a poison that enters the ticks' bodies through their feet, and they die. So if all goes well in trials, will this mean the end of ticks? Holly Gaff says no.
I don't think we should ever try to eliminate ticks. They're certainly a huge part of the ecosystem.
She's the rover team's tick expert and an associate professor of biological sciences at Old Dominion University.
They do serve as a prey source for a lot of other animals. So if you start saying, well, let's eliminate all ticks, well, you'd eliminate a lot of those birds that may rely on that for a lot of their food source. And so ecologically, it's not a good idea.
But that's the nice thing about the rover. It targets a small area, the area of your yard where ticks live.
We will give them the woods, but we're not giving them our yard. We will give them, you know, the deep woods there, but not the paths along that we want kids to be able to play in.
They're still testing the product, but your honey-do list of leaf blowing, gutter cleaning, and pruning the hedges could very soon include tick roving. I'm Kelly Libby.
Thanks so much for your listening time today. If you'd like what you heard, there's much more to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here, on listener-supported NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.